Right, I think it's 5 o'clock, so we can perhaps start. This is the last session, in fact, of the seminar on architecture that's been going on now for a couple of years. So Anthony is our final speaker, and we are, needless to say, very pleased to welcome him. Anthony Garatti is Professor of the History of Art at the University of York, and chairman of the Society of Architectural Historians of Great Britain. He has published books and articles on Sir Christopher Wren and the English Baroque. His talk will consider the design of Castle Howard, a spectacular country house that was begun to the designs of Sir John Vanbrugh and Nicola Hawksmoor in 1699. The talk will consider the nature and purpose of architectural ornament in the English Baroque period.
Okay, thank you. And can I start by firstly saying thank you very much for the invitation. It's a great pleasure to be here. I'm seldom asked to speak about British architectural history outside the English-speaking world, so it's a great pleasure to be here in France. And secondly, more importantly, I must apologise for not being able to speak to you in French. I'm the product of all that's worst in the English educational system. So I have to speak to you in English. I apologise. I would like to begin my discussion of Castle Howard with this wonderful image, a bird's eye view, which comes from a book called Vitruvius Britannicus, the British Vitruvius, and was published in 1725. It shows Castle Howard, which was begun, as we've just heard, in 1699 for a member of the English upper classes, Charles Howard, the third Earl of Carlisle, and the house is still in the possession of his family. And it was designed by the two architects, Sir John Vanbrugh, whom I think you've already had a paper on earlier in this series. And Vanbrugh was assisted by another architect called Nicholas Hawksmoor. I deliberately begin with a representation of the house, with an image of the house, not only for illustrative purposes, because this striking method of architectural representation reveals something important about how Castle Howard was conceived, I think, by its architects. Firstly, and perhaps obviously, that the house was designed to be looked at. And secondly, that the building was informed in its actual design by an expectation that we would be looking at it. If this is so, you may ask, why do I show you the view of a bird, albeit an imaginary bird? Firstly, because this beautiful image reveals at a glance, in an instant, and I think this is the point of the image, what was most original about the architecture of the house, namely that the design includes, in addition to the main block, which you can see in the centre, two sets of wings on the entrance side of the house, which we can see here. The wings are located at right angles to the main pile of the house, here and here. And to the south, at the far side, as you can broadly see, a further pair of wings are directly attached to the main part of the house, so here and here. So here's the main part of the house, one set of wings, and another set of wings. The main pile of the house, then, is drawn into a very different composition to the front and to the back, and the surmounting dome is the only constant feature, and this pivotal function was probably a factor in the decision to introduce a dome, an unusual and unprecedented thing to do, in England at least. To the north, the forecourt arrangement is consistent with the grandest house of the period in England and Scotland. It is, broadly speaking, Palladian, that is, inspired by the architecture of Andrea Palladio. The south front, to the garden, is more original, but it too is loosely Palladian in origin. Not only are these two compositions, front and back, unrelated, but each seems calculated to obscure the other, at least when viewed from the main axis, as we're doing here, and, of course, down on the ground. But the decision to represent the house from above reveals the four-armed plan of the house that the architectural historian Charles Summery Smith memorably likened to a crab. My six-year-old son recently told me something that I had forgotten, or in fact never knew, which is that crabs walk sideways. And the plan of Castle Howard performs a similar maneuver along the ridge-like hill on which it sits, where there are these extended arrangements of outbuildings, not all of which were built, kitchens and stables. These extended outbuildings obscure the sides of the house, and they extend the separation of front and back. And there are the two sides of the house. Sorry, no, I'm being momentarily confused here. Here is the garden side of the house. Okay. So to move to the architectural detail, the unrelated nature of front and back is extended to the articulation. And by the word articulation, I mean the specific architectural detailing, the textures and ornaments, the facades of Castle Howard. This difference begins with the choice of order. Doric on the front, you can see on the left, and Corinthian on the back. And the difference is continued with the treatment of the wall surfaces. It's textured on the north front, you can see here, and it's smooth, at least the underlying wall plane is smooth on the garden site. And these wall surfaces, moreover, are then contrasted with the respective orders, which are plain on the north front. So we have a plain order against a textured wall on this side. And on the right, we have a textured order against a plain wall. The subject matter of the carved ornament, that's to say the non-architectural ornament, the figurative ornament, is similarly differentiated, but I'm not going to say very much about that today. I'm going to focus very much on the architectural ornament. Describing these differences to the patron, the Earl of Carlisle, one of the architects of Castle Howard, Nicholas Hawksmoor, who was almost certainly responsible for detailing this building, noted without apology that, and I quote, "The south side and north side of your lordship's house cannot be seen together at the same time, nor at any time upon the diagonal or angular view," end of quote. This echoes the architect Sir Christopher Wren, who at about the same time wrote in a theoretical piece of writing that, and I quote, "In things that are not seen at once and have no respect to one another, great variety is commendable," end of quote. This attitude is likewise apparent at the so-called King William block at Greenwich Hospital, just outside London, which was a royal foundation, a hospital for elderly members of the Royal Navy. This building, or this group of buildings, was designed at exactly the same time as Castle Howard. And here the outward facade to Greenwich, the town, has a Doric order, and you can see that above, while the inner facade to the hospital itself has a different order, a composite order. And I suspect that all three of these architects, if pressed, would have cited the Palace of Versailles, which I'm not going to illustrate, which is Doric on the entrance front, Ionic on the garden, though Versailles, as all of you know, was not designed in one go. These various statements, then, with their emphasis on aspects of how we look and experience this building, confirm what I have already observed of the building, that the difference between the front and the back is related to the experience of looking at this building. And this is a plan of the house here. I'm not going to say very much about the inside of Castle Howard today, but I just want to show you here, through these coloured lines, which I've drawn over a photocopy, how one experiences Castle Howard, and how the experience of standing in front of these volumes, architectural volumes, determines the extent to which the facades are detailed. So all of this facade here in blue is treated in one way, but as soon as the building turns the corner and becomes invisible, the ornament of the building drops away and the building becomes very plain, utilitarian at the back. And similarly, when one's standing in the garden, the very different treatment, the very different mood of this facade is continued, wrapped around the corner, and then it stops very abruptly because you can't see it. However, and it's an important however, when we experience Castle Howard in the real, on the ground, we don't have to walk very far or try very hard to experience the dual nature of the house or the blank treatments of its wall surfaces, apparently invisible wall surfaces. When we look at the main pile of the house from an elevated view, and the topography, the landscape of the garden allows us, indeed invites us, to do so, we can easily discern the edges of both facades, front and back, at the same time, and see that the same architectural volume is being treated in different ways at front and back. Sorry, wrong image. Here. So as you climb the hill, you can begin to see that this side of the house is treated in one way, and this side is treated in another way, and in between, the facade is treated in a very plain, utilitarian way. Similarly here, once you're up and you start to see the back of the side wings, you can see that it's treated in this very plain way, and even the quality of the masonry, the sizes of the pieces of stones, becomes much less polite and impressive than it is on the main facades of front and back. So this is a house, in many respects, that has no sides, or rather seems indifferent, the architecture seems indifferent to its sides. In short, while the design of Castle Howard presupposes two advantages or aspects, and as I hope I've persuaded you, to a very significant degree responds to these aspects or advantages, we should not presume that the appearance of the building is meant to deceive. This is not Baroque illusionism, and I'm going to resist the temptation to draw analogies, because I think that's what they are, between Vanbrugh's architecture and Vanbrugh's experience of the theatre as a playwright, though we may return to this in the discussion. The building, then, is not seeking to delude us about itself. The frankness with which it reveals its discontinuities, it seems to me, rules out such an interpretation. Here is another example of this. This is a nice detail of one of the entrance wings. What we're looking at here is this corner right down here, which you can see was always visible within the entrance forecourt. And as the building turns the corner, this very textured treatment of the facade just stops. And we can see something of this frankness in this drawing here, which I'm afraid is quite difficult to see because it's a very fine pencil drawing. This has never been published, This is a very remarkable drawing designed by Nicholas Hawksmoor, today preserved at the Victoria and Albert Museum in London, which shows the house from a diagonal vantage now, rather than on axis, unlike the celebrated bird's eye view with which I began. And this uncompromisingly shows us the blank faces of the edges of the house. So the two contrasts I have just described, the contrast between the articulation of the front and back, and the contrast between that which is articulated and that which is not, so that's the elaborate facades and then the very plain facades, these two contrasts testifies, I think, to a very highly developed notion of what a facade is meant to do on a building or for a building. By highly developed, I mean that the facade is, to a degree, autonomous. The articulation of this building, as I've shown you, stops and starts, and it says different things about the same thing. And this is because it was conceived, I think, as an overlay. So there are two distinct treatments of the outside of Castle Howard. Firstly, there are the principal volumes of the building, which we might usefully think of as the building as the project. I'm talking now about Castle Howard as a whole and the basic silhouette that we see in front of us. Then there are those parts of the building that are picked out, or those parts of the outside of the building that are picked out for surface enrichment. They are very self-consciously treated as facades. And I like to call those the building as the object, as the visual object. There is, of course, a relationship between these two registers. The facades are there to comment on the house, and they do so visually via architectural ornament. And one of the things I'm keen to do as an architectural historian is to understand the extent to which architecture is a visual medium and that its subject matter is architecture. This is architecture about architecture. That's one of my themes today. But we can nevertheless identify a third protagonist at Castle Howard. We've mentioned him or her already, the beholder, the viewer, the person to whom the facades are knowingly addressed. For consistency's sake, we might call this beholder, the subject, the person looking at the house. So we have three protagonists at Castle Howard: the project, by which I mean the building as a whole, the object, by which I mean certain facades which are picked out for enrichment, and then the subject, the person who is looking. The facades themselves occupy the middle position, spatially and functionally. As such, they are, and I'm punning on the word here, I'm not sure if this would work in French, they are the medium, the facades are the medium of the building. They are the medium in that they are about architecture, they are of architecture, and they are the medium in that they are in the middle. This is a rather complicated way of describing the classical system of decorum, namely that the meaning of a speech in classical rhetorical theory was effectively conveyed by the appropriate use of language, i.e. by literary style. Thanks to Vitruvius, the author of the one text on architecture to survive from classical antiquity, this idea or this notion of decorum became part of the mainstay of Renaissance architectural theory. And I think it justifies the application of the word style to the two very different fronts of Castle Howard. And the word style, I think, from rhetorical theory, was used in this period by Wren, Hawksmoor, and Vanbrugh. Now, for the process to work visually, for there to be a visual system of decorum, the appearance of the facades must be judged appropriate by architect, patron, and presumably anyone who bothers to look. But for this to work, the forms of the building must have some kind of content, for how else, without content, can they be deemed appropriate to their function or their location? At Castle Howard, and in Sir John Vanbrugh's houses more generally, the key ideas, the key content of this architecture, is magnificence and durability. And these are two words that occur frequently in the writings of British architects in this period, and in more broadly in literature, where these terms were often deployed in as part of metaphor when architecture is pulled in as a way of describing other things. Magnificence and durability. Today I want to focus not on magnificence, but on durability. But in this period, these concepts, these ideas, or these characters are overlapping concepts, primarily because they derive again from Vitruvius and his celebrated statement that architecture should be composed or be comprised of three things: of strength, of utility or function, and beauty. And for Vanbrugh, I want to argue today, magnificence, or state, as he sometimes called it, refers to utility, the Vitruvian notion of function, and durability to strength, to firmitas. So the idea of firmitas, that a good building, a high-status building, has to be a strong building. There's a similar idea with these concrete walls. Fortunately, Hawksmoor, who, as we've already seen, almost certainly detailed Castle Howard, provides a detailed description of them. And this occurs in a letter to the Earl of Carlisle, written many years later, in September 1734. And the letter also sheds light on the ideas that underpin the designs of the facade. And I have a photocopy here, which I completely forgot I had brought, but I have it here. So I'll pass this round for you to read at leisure. Make sure I don't distribute my plane ticket home by mistake. So Hawksmoor, in this letter, is explaining the detail of the facades to the patron. So this is a very important commentary by an architect about his own design from this period. He was writing to a purpose to oppose a proposal or a plan recently suggested to the Earl of Carlisle to rusticate, that's to say, to treat part of the facade as a series of rough pieces of stone, rough pieces of masonry. Hawksmoor begins with an admission. The north front, he states, was intended much in the same style as Mr. Inigo Jones and Mr. Webb, two leading architects of the early 17th century in England, and their work here, again, at Greenwich Hospital. Greenwich is a key place in the development of English architecture at this period. He says at Greenwich, I quote, that the basement and grand plinth upon which all the superstructure was to be deposited should be plain. He's talking about this bit down here, whereas the main part of the facade you could see is textured again, whereas here it's smooth. And again, it's this contrast between smoothness and texture that's very important. So he characterizes this. He says that the basement and grand plinth upon which all the superstructure, so that's the whole of the upper part of the building, was to be deposited, and that this should be plain and appear one solid stone or rock, the better to distinguish the upper order as well as to sustain it. So there's some very interesting, rich language and thinking going on in this quotation, in this letter. And he then describes how this same reasoning, this same way of understanding the architecture was applied to Castle Howard, as you can read at leisure in the handout. But let me summarize what I think is significant about this text. There are two main ideas at play in the letter. The first is what I term differentiation, a rather complicated word for the production of visual contrast, not only for its own sake, but in order to create a hierarchy of parts. The contrast is affected at Castle Howard by, as we've seen, varying degrees of texture and elaboration. The basement of the north front, Hawksmoor explains, and here he's talking about down here, running across the bottom of the north facade. This is, he says, plain, the better to distinguish the upper order, while the upper order is rusticated. When he uses the word order here, he's not referring to the pilasters, as architectural historians tend to. He's referring to the whole level, the whole area. That's an interesting use of language there. Hawksmoor analyzes the south front of the house in similar terms, where he argues, where's my image of this gone? No, I've mislaid my image, but I'll leave that. But he's talking about the different, here we are, it's this facade here. You can't actually see it in this image, but down below the smooth wall here, at the bottom of the facade, the idea is that that there are lots of different pieces of stone. And he says here that now it's the basement that's rusticated, by which he states the contrast and disparity between the basement and the order become visibly remarkable. A nice phrase, that, visibly remarkable, visually knowable. And he likens this system of visual contrast to a machine. I'm not quite sure what he means by machine. A machine composed of different parts, limbs, or members. One would not, he writes, have them blend and melt into one mass so as not to be able to distinguish the noble parts from the inferior, hierarchy again, the basement from the order that rests upon it. This is standard Vitruvian stuff. The process of differentiation that Hawksmoor describes depends on more than the internal logic of visual contrast, for it was additionally underpinned by a metaphorical conceit grounded in pictorial representation. And I'm now moving to my thesis that this is architecture that is very self-consciously about architecture. What does the architecture here mean? Well, it means architecture. The conceit relates to the architectonics, by which I mean the physics of architectural construction, and more specifically to the relative sizes and therefore the relative strengths of stones. Thus, he repeatedly describes the plain basement of the north front, which you can see here, as a rock, as one solid stone or rock, as a grand entire plinth made out of one solid rock of stone. These are all quotations from the letter. And a solid rock quit plane. As such, he writes, it is equipped to receive the deposited superstructure of the house itself. Hawksmoor's discussion of the facades in terms of load-bearing stones, that's to say stones which are subject to forces, physical forces from above, all of this, however, bears a very limited relationship to the actual structure of the building. Thus, the main plinth, which we see here, again on the left, was conceptualized as a single piece of rock, whereas you can see from my image that is in actual fact a wall composed of separate stones, but with the joints suitably effaced. Nor does the plinth perform the supporting role of platform that Hawksmoor claims for it, for rather than extending beneath the deposited superstructure of the house like a giant foundation, it in actual fact fronts an elevated basement that extends beneath the whole of the house. Hence the windows that are set into the plinth here, which Hawksmoor conveniently forgets to mention because they're not compatible with his conceptualization of the architectural detail. In general terms, however, Hawksmoor does acknowledge this difference or this displacement between the structural idea of the classical articulation and the structural reality of the building. The plinth, he writes, should appear one solid stone or rock, appear. Similarly, it, and I quote, represents a grand plinth. It is, he quotes, like a solid rock. In other words, the architectural ornament of the north front is a picture of architectural structure. But crucially, it is a picture that is informed by the material and tensile, that's to say the stresses and strains of stone, it's informed by the material of the structure that it purports to be. And as such, it's free to exaggerate because it's pictorial. And it's the exaggeration of structure, in my view, that is the dominant idea of English Baroque architecture and is the one place, I think, where one can make a meaningful connection between Vanbrugh's work in the theatre and in architecture, this tendency towards exaggeration. So, the visualization of durability, of architectural strength, is not a rationalist approach to design, as in 18th century French architecture, since it is not actual structure that is being foregrounded and shown to the viewer at Castle Howard, at least not on the outside. And Vanbrugh acknowledged this difference in 1711 when he refers in another letter to, quote, the appearance and reality of strength in the fabric. So there's the appearance of strength in the building, and there's the reality of strength. He sees those as two separate things. So what do Vanbrugh and Hawksmoor and the architects of the English Baroque mean when they talk about the appearance of strength in the fabric? The word appearance suggests not only the object known, the building that we're looking at, but the perception of the knowing subject, the person looking at the building and the experience of the building in here. And this brings us back to the three protagonists I identified above, the outer face of the building, the object, and the perception of the beholder, the subject. Well, those two I want to focus on now. The word appearance, then, and the frequency with which it's deployed by Vanbrugh and Hawksmoor suggests a relationship between these two protagonists, between object and subject. And this is indeed so, since the facade, for the reasons we have already discussed, indeed presumes a beholder. It's quite explicitly something separate or attached to the building itself. Hawksmoor and Vanbrugh's thinking here is not Cartesian, by which I mean to say that their use of the word appearance is not seeking to remove the viewer or the beholder from the external world. Rather, their aesthetic theory, like Sir Christopher Wren's famous statements on beauty, on the causes of beauty, this theory is a naturalized one, by which I mean that it's a theory that locates the beholder in the world, in Wren's case, via the optics of the eye. But it's a strand of thinking that nevertheless acknowledges an important truth about how we as embodied subjects experience architecture and the extent to which buildings are knowable by sensation alone. Appearance is limited for a basic reason. We cannot see through walls, or I can't see through walls. I don't think most of you can either. It is therefore up to the facade to communicate the firmitas, the strength of the project, not least in view of that substantial dome about which I've not said very much, which looms above the structure, a solid masonry, heavy form that hints, to quote Vanbrugh again, the reality of strength in the fabric. What relationship, if any, then, does this fictive structure that I have identified have to the house itself, to the building that lies beyond it, the building as the project? Is it mere facade, as I've suggested? Mostly, I think it is. There is no reason, for example, for the dramatic thickening of the facade to left and right. I'm referring here to this part of the facade here and this part, which you can probably just make out. These pilasters here, they don't frame windows, they frame niches that contain sculpture. So the ends of the facade, and similarly these parts here, are without any kind of opening. They are solid and they project forward. So the facade is thickened, or at least it appears to be thickened. This is, in terms of what the building needs to stand up, structurally redundant, as we can see from the plans. I've just been drawing attention to this detail here, and you can see that this, in actual fact, fronts a corridor, and similarly here. There's no need for any of this thickening of the facade. But the matter is more complicated in the central projection. That's here. If you just bear with me for 1 minute. So that there is in plan this here. And here we see it again at the ground floor and at the upper floor. Now, where the plan is concerned, the thickening of the wall and the projection of the wall towards the beholder, in actual fact, accommodates two spiral, what we call in English, two spiral staircases. You see those there, the circular stairs, which rise from the basement of the house up to the roof and which provide the only access to the dome via the roof structure. Moreover, on the first floor, on the upper level, which you can see on the lower plan there, these staircases are linked by a passageway that's cut through the thickness of the wall. You can just see that here, like an actual castle. We might return to why Castle Howard is called Castle Howard later. A passageway cut through the thickness of the wall, thereby providing access for the servants to the bedrooms located immediately behind the facade. So the central projection of Castle Howard isn't quite as solid as the articulation of the exterior facade would have us believe, a difference that is nicely concealed by the statues in the niches you can see here, which serve a secondary purpose, which is to conceal and obscure the narrow, slit-like windows that are actually located at the back of the niches. So the idea of the niche is that it reveals the thickness of the wall, but in actual fact, if the statues were removed, the niche would be revealing the thinness of the wall. Okay, so there's a tension between what the building is pretending it's doing and what the building is actually doing. But the middle of the facade, of the north facade, is nevertheless pretty solid. And that brings us to the section of the building. By section, I mean the, I think you call it the coupe in front, the cut through the building. And from the Vitruvian notion of utility back to firmitas, we should not underestimate the structural complexity of the Great Hall. So here we are. This is the wonderful space that you see when you first come into Castle Howard. Not only is the dome a weighty structure, it's massively heavy because it's constructed from stone up to and including the drum, so that's right the way up the cylinder, it's solid masonry. But it's also structurally integrated within the two-story composition of the house itself, a very complex thing to do. So in other words, the dome is the space of the dome. I'm afraid this is probably the one moment in this talk where I'm going to talk about space. The space of the dome is continuous from the floor of the hall to the top of the dome itself above. Now, unlike Palladio's Villa Rotunda, for example, and unlike the double-height saloons of late 17th century France, from which I think the basic concept of this space was derived, Vanbrugh spent time in France. Unlike those examples, however, here, the dome doesn't rise directly on a cone. So if you imagine a cone and then a dome on top, here what happens is the dome rises over a square space, a square plan, and that necessitates the introduction of these triangular forms here, which affect the transition from the square plan below to the circular plan of the dome. In English, they're called pendentives. And they result in a form that immediately, and this will probably be even more so to you in this country, here in France, they immediately make the building look like a church, like the crossing of a great Baroque church. And I think this is the only use of a dome carried on pendentives in domestic architecture. You have to go all the way back to Byzantium, really, to find domes on pendentives in domestic architecture. But I think the reason that they are there is to do with this notion of thermotas. Here, not the representation of thermotas, but the actual reality of thermotas. Christopher Wren argues in his theoretical writings, and they were prepared at about this time, that the dome on pendentives is the strongest way of constructing a dome. And he says it's stronger than anything the Romans themselves devised, and because it's the strongest form, it's the one that architects should use. So the physics of the form is more important for Wren, ultimately, than the historical cultural origins of the form. It is, Wren writes, so natural, end of quote. It was a natural form. That may be so, but it nevertheless unleashes a set of mighty forces that need to be contained and stabilized within this complex architectural structure. At Castle Howard, the forces are countered by a series of lateral walls and arches. You see them here. And I think these are all, as well as serving social functions, and people always talk about them in relation to their social functions, corridors, etc., they're also serving a structural function. They are holding the structure in place. So here in the Great Hall of Castle Howard, the appearance of strength and the reality of strength coincide. But it's probably the one place where they do. But I can't say this for certain, because statics, the study of architectural forces, unlike dynamics, cannot be seen. It's the nature of statics that they're still. So you can't know them. Back to my point about the limits of what we can know about architecture from our eyes alone. Ideas of strength can also be articulated here. This is the basement of the garden front, where the idea of the bottom of the building as a plinth, as a supporting member, is brilliantly exaggerated. Again, this idea of exaggeration. Here, the idea is no longer that of the single piece of rock, but of a composite wall dramatically thickened. Firstly, by an additional level of channeled masonry projecting forward, and secondly, by this wonderful deep buttress-like moulding which extends forward towards the garden. One imagines the various components firmly fixed in place, like a pile of massive pieces of stone, roughly hewn from a quarry, or recently hewn from a quarry. Again, then, we see an ornamental vocabulary that draws attention to the component elements of masonry construction and their role in that construction. Now, I've got a rather complicated bit coming up in this talk, which we'll get through quickly, and then I'm nearly done. Now, in the articulation, though that's in the treatment of the decoration of the wall surfaces at Castle Howard, a plain expanse of wall, as I've argued already, and as Hawksmoor tells us, a plain expanse of wall represents an uninterrupted piece of stone. So we're meant to believe that this is a single piece of stone. But in the unmediated treatment of the fabric itself, a plain expanse of wall, as you can see up near the ladder there, a plain expanse of wall represents nothing at all. It just is a plain expanse of wall. And this gives rise at Castle Howard to attention, because the actual wall has had representation thrust upon it, thereby conceptualizing it as the opposite of what it is. So let me try and explain what I'm saying. This tension arises because of the self-representational nature of this architecture. This is, as I've said, as I'm trying to argue, architecture about architecture. It is a building pretending to be a building. If a coursed wall, and by a coursed wall I simply mean a wall that is constructed as a series of superimposed pieces of cut stone, if a coursed wall is intended to represent a solid piece of rock, in other words, its opposite, how is it possible to make a coursed wall represent a coursed wall? You see, the problem, it already is a coursed wall. And this is the dilemma of things representing themselves. It is, in essence, the same problem as this on the right. How can I tell the difference between a picture and a picture of a picture? And in both cases, it's the shared medium, architecture about architecture, painting about painting, that undermines or complicates the possibility of representation. In the painting, representation takes representation as its subject matter. This is not a painting of flowers, this is a painting of a painting of flowers. Similarly, or I want to argue, at Castle Howard, structure takes structure as its subject matter. But how to prize them apart? Where painting is concerned, then the answer is this, the self-reflexive gesture, the introduction of the curtain. Where architecture is concerned, the solution at Castle Howard is a similar one, to overlay the structural reality of a coursed wall with a picture of a coursed wall by introducing these incisions into the wall. Thus, architectural striation is represented by the introduction of what's already there, namely line, as we can see here, whereas structural solidity is represented by the effacement of structural line, by the effacement of what is actually there. And here you can see these two different approaches. So here is the coursed wall pretending to be a solid wall, and here is the coursed wall pretending to be a coursed wall. So as we can see on the right, and here we're in one of the links between the main house and the wing at Castle Howard, the wall is incised horizontally. Now I should say immediately that this is a standard feature of the French classical tradition in architecture. But its realization at Castle Howard, as we'll see in a minute, is slightly different from the normal way in which this is detailed in French architecture of the same period. I'm arguing here that this is pictorial architecture, and that the incisions that have been cut into the surface here can be understood as essentially graphic, by which I mean they relate to drawing or to image making. Indeed, they were probably understood in relation to architectural engraving. That's not architectural engraving, it's the building itself. But it illustrates my point, which is that they're not actually lines, they're incisions, square-shaped in profile. But as you can see here, they fill up with multiple shadows and thereby come to resemble thick black lines. And the building starts to look like a representation of a building rather than a building itself. However, the actual wall is not completely effaced, of course, because it's still there to be seen in front of us. Indeed, in a very subtle way, the presence of the actual wall lends psychological force to the picture of the wall. For the incisions also draw attention to the depth and solidity of the wall itself. The real wall therefore reasserts itself, since the incisions, or channels, allow us to see something, let's call it a glimpse, of its depth and solidity and strength, which would of course be impossible in an unmediated wall. When we look at a wall, it's impossible to, a smooth wall, it's impossible to know whether it's that thick or that thick. So by handling the wall in this way, the intrinsic nature of the wall is expressed, communicating something of its heaviness to the viewer. Thus, the incision provides a visual clue for a non-visual sensation, weight. And I'm running out of time, so I was just I'll skip over some of this, but the point I was going to make here was, and it's rather perhaps more detailed than you want or need, but I wanted to draw attention to the way that these incisions are cut into the architecture. Well, that's the conceit. So here is, if we look at the relationship between the main plane of the wall and the architectural mouldings, you can see here the wall begins its descent and then these incisions are cut into it. And that's what's unusual about this architecture. Now my next image has failed to materialise. It was a detail of Greenwich Hospital. If you go and look closely at this building, here you can see a wall, and then the rustication, these stripes on the facade, are treated like panels that have been laid over the surface of the wall. So there's no sense of them actually projecting out of the building. They're just thin things that have been stuck on the outside of the main plane of the wall. And that makes a very subtle difference to how we perceive the treatment of the surface in relation to the extension, the depth of the intrinsic wall, the depth of the wall. Okay. So the channeled treatment, that's the term we use in English, the channeled treatment of the wall here pertains to its depth. And I think this is confirmed by the treatment of the door at the right-hand side of my image here, and this is my favourite moment at Castle Howard. The thickness of the wall is expressed by the continuation of the channeling round the edges of the doorway, and then, remarkably, it reappears on the inside of the building. The image on the right there is the inside of the building. So we have these forms that are almost always associated with the exterior buildings are brought into the building. So the actual thickness of the wall is carried through. So, in conclusion, I have associated Vanbrugh's notion of the appearance of strength in the fabric, his words, with the articulation of the building and with a close analysis of the architectural ornament. For it's here, on the facades, that ideas of strength are represented and, I hope I've persuaded you, communicated. This is done pictorially by the suggestion of massive, uninterrupted structural members, massive pieces of stone, and by the direct relationship that's drawn between the extent of these forms and their capacity to support other forms. I don't refer to the mass of the stones. The word mass, as I'm sure many of you will know, is a word invented by Isaac Newton at almost exactly this time. But I can find no suggestion that the various elements of this fictitious architecture were intended to convey varying degrees of density. That's to say, some stones were more compressible than others. This is not the visual expression of Newtonian physics, much as I would like it to be. All of this, or most of this, is pictorial. It's articulation, and it lies on the surface of the building. And that brings us back for one final time, then, to its intermediary location, the fact that it's the link between the building and the experience of and the person who is experiencing the building. Without that person, there would be no point to any of it. The articulation lies on the surface because, as I've argued, strength and weight are difficult things to know by sight alone. We cannot hold a building in our hands, thus we cannot know it by touch, nor can we know its solidity by sight alone. But enabling the beholder to know solidity is what the articulation of Castle Howard seems to be doing. And I deliberately use the word know, for to know something goes deeper than to see something, goes deeper into us now, not into the wall. I've suggested some contributing factors to this experience, the articulation of structure on the surface and the partial revelation of the wall. If we focus our intention on the viewer, we might ask, how is it possible to know an idea of strength and weight from articulation, from looking at architectural form? This is ultimately a question of visual perception, and I don't have a smart answer for you. But when I look at the pilaster articulation of Castle Howard, I experience the same architectonic sensation that I feel when I look at the trilithons of Stonehenge, when this is likewise brought before my perception. Now, an older school of art history sought to explain this experience with empathy theory, and I'm reluctant to go down that route because empathy theory sits in the intellectual history of the 19th century and not the 17th century. But I would like to offer one historical, partial explanation. And this again brings us back to Christopher Wren and his architectural theory, where in his definition of architectural beauty, or the causes of architectural beauty, he discusses architectural form in terms of line and figure. Okay? But unlike Alberti before him, he understands these lines to be not only applicable to the world, i.e. a means of describing the world, that's what geometry is, but they are also subject to the world and the natural properties and forces of the world. Okay? So having told us that, quote, geometrical figures are naturally more beautiful than any other irregular, unquote, and that the square and circle are the most beautiful forms of all, nothing very original there, he states more originally that, quote, position is necessary for perfecting beauty. There are, he continues, only two beautiful positions of straight lines, perpendicular and horizontal. This is from nature and consequently necessity, no other than upright being firm. So in other words, an upright line is beautiful because if you stick something on top of it, it will be strong. But if you start to tilt it, because of our sense of how that will work structurally, it starts to become ugly. Okay? Or that's what Wren is arguing. So Wren is arguing that statics doesn't only define that which is firm, that which is strong, but it also defines that which is beautiful, and that it does so in plane as well as extended geometry, in two as well as three dimensions. So when we look at a diagram of something, we can feel its strength, even though it's just a series, the form is just a series of lines. And I think something of this thinking underpins the very developed nature of these facades in English architecture at this period, which, as you can see, are basically linear graphic representations of architectural form. So in conclusion, one wider observation, that the weightiness of Vanbrugh's architecture, apparent or actual, has an important bearing on the shift in taste that occurred in the early decades of the 18th century. Very suddenly, and in a way that still hasn't been explained, the English upper classes became repulsed by this kind of architecture. It's a shift that architectural historians refer to as the shift from the English Baroque to what we now call English Palladianism. I've argued that the exaggerated stoniness, that's of the former, was in many respects Vitruvian. It was the Vitruvian notion that that which is strong is that which is beautiful. Their buildings record a widely held article of faith in early modern Britain, and I suspect Europe, that to build strongly was to build admirably, because to build well was to build confidently into the future. That's what durability is about. It implies it has a temporal dimension into the future as well as a statical one. But for reasons which we still don't properly understand, and this is what my next book is probably going to be about, or trying to understand this, this article of faith became anathema. It was rejected, especially amongst the upper classes who were commissioning country houses. English architectural patrons decided they no longer wanted their buildings to look heavy and strong, and in doing so, they were repudiating a tradition of architecture that was ultimately derived from natural philosophical thinking. And they erected in its place an idea of architecture. And here's an example. This is Chiswick Villa outside London. Erected in its place an idea of architecture that was, broadly speaking, more conceptual, associational, and historical. It was less about nature than it was about culture. So look at Chiswick and feel its weightlessness. The wall now assumes a paper-like quality, arguably the paper-like quality of the paper source, a Palladian drawing, from which this facade was copied. This is a built piece of paper. That's how it came into being. These buildings are fascinating in themselves, and they appeal to architectural historians because one can recover their erudition, and that reflects well on us. But they're something very different from the kind of architecture I've been trying to characterize this evening. It is, as we would say in English, lightweight, but it's also highbrow. I'm not going to try and translate that. Why the architectonics of architecture became repulsive to the English upper classes is yet to be explained, but I suspect that such an explanation would go to the heart of this crucial moment of change. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the beautiful talk and beautiful illustrations as well, and I'm sure there will be plenty of questions I could start, but I won't. To listen to your colleagues and students as well.
I've stunned you all. I'll show you an image. This is a joke image. When I was walking into work, when I was thinking about this talk, this is a building site. Constructors care about appearance. I'm not sure what they're referring to, but it just struck a chord with the argument I've been making today.
Appearance at the work site or the appearance of the finished
buildings? I think, I'm not sure what they're referring to there. So I think they're referring to themselves, looking smart.
Right.
I think.
Yes,
that probably
is it. So it's nothing really to do with what I'm talking about, but it's just the way the word appearance, because the word keeps appearing in my sources, and there it was next to a building site.
So, anybody?
Yes, Natalie.
Two questions as I listened to your fascinating talk.
Thank you.
The first one was, you mentioned the sort of weightiness and stoniness, and as you talked, we became more and more convinced that that was the case, especially with that image of Stonehenge. But at the same time, is there not a sort of counter movement in that there are all these windows that make it very airy, and at the same time,
yes,
the dome weighs the whole thing down, but you can also, with the pillars and the dome, you sort of feel that you're soaring upwards.
Yes.
So I was just wondering about that.
Yeah, no, I think I do see that. There is a sort of strong sense, almost of elevation, mm-hmm. isn't there, in the facade. I think that comes from the fact that the forms are apparently supporting things, and I think that also... so it's grounded in the same things I've been talking about, but it does, but the aesthetic or the visual effect of that is also about drawing lines up through the facade so that you can see the lines of support, the sort of vertical lines of support, and not just in this building, but in many buildings by Hawksmoor and Vanbrugh, you can see forms put on top of things. I mean, I rushed over this image here, but to me this is somehow the archetypal English Baroque building, because we have this apparently massive, weighty pyramid on a gate, and as an architectural historian, one's first attempt to explain this is to think about it in relation to history and time, and to think, well, why is Egypt being brought to this place? But I think if one stops worrying about history and asks what's it doing as a natural form, as a physical object, it's telling you that the arch and the wall is strong. Do you see what I mean? But here again, I think that it isn't just pushing down, that the forms are working up as well. But I think in both cases, they're grounded in physical... But I need to think more about how it works up as well as down.
I was also wondering, when you said this architecture had a sort of pictorial quality in it, you also showed us the inside and paintings inside.
Yes.
I was wondering... To what extent there was a collaboration between the architects and the painters, or if, you know, was there, especially when you showed us the base of the dome where there was...
Yes.
I've forgotten the name of the...
It's Pellegrini, yeah. Well, they don't work with the building in the sense that they don't... well, they sort of work with the building. For example... There are different registers in the painting. So here we have a conceit of objects being hung on the wall, and the underlying hue, the underlying colour here, is presumably to suggest continuation of masonry. And look at the way you can just see from this slide that I can't remember what this form is. It's kind of sort of festive-like form is. Spilling out of its frame, as it were. So there's a sense of things being hung on the architecture. Elsewhere, we don't get that to the same way. We have a more sort of conventional illusionistic thing of the architecture being opened up to reveal this world of allegorical figures. But in another way, the painted decoration does work with the architecture, and I think this is a point that sounds rather obvious, but it's one that people who write about this kind of painted decoration tend not to make, where the literature tends to assume that the meaning of these forms is somehow brought in. But I think in a way these forms work with the building, and they work with the shape of the building. So, for example, up in the very top of the dome, which I can't show you, we have the fall of Phaeton, as described in Ovid. And that's a story about height. So it's articulating the building. And so in the same way that the facades are a kind of commentary on the building, there's a similar relationship going on between the narratives that are being selected here and where they occur in the building. Do you see what I mean? But I have a colleague who works on this stuff, and he hates it when I say that, because he says I'm just reducing it to... You know, it's become subservient to the architecture. But I mean, there are other things I suspect going on as well. But I mean, I think this is a very French concept. This is what the French call the salle à l'italienne, the double-heighted domed space, Vaux-le-Vicomte, and places like that. And this combination of masonry on the inside of a building is very unusual in English architecture before this period, but of course is absolutely characteristic of French architecture, with this wonderful celebration of the cutting of stone and the complexity and the geometric knowledge that is involved in creating these stony, these wonderful stony interiors that have always been such a characteristic feature of France, but is unusual in England. And again, I think it ties in with that idea that this is strong architecture. You bring the stone into the interior aesthetic of the building. Even arches. I mean, we see arches as these beautiful decorative features, but remember that an arch is itself an incredibly strong form, because to make an arch you have to build with carpentry what's called the centering, a scaffold, and then you place the pieces on, and it doesn't need any mortar. The whole thing is held in tension. So an arch is itself strong. And this is the first house in English domestic architecture to have arched windows. Now, French architecture has had arched windows, you know, for a generation. It may simply be that, but I think there's an idea going on as well that an arch window is a strong window, and you can see the way the treatment of the stone above here is suggesting, in pictorial terms, each of these wedges. I think this a point I hinted at but didn't actually explore is that this is what makes Castle Howard a castle. It's not a castle because it looks like a medieval building, but it's because people didn't think like that in the early modern period. That sense of equating form with history, I think, just doesn't ordinarily operate in the way it does in later moments of history. But it has the qualities that a castle needs to have in order to be a castle. It has to be strong, impregnable, and there's something of that there. But there are also big windows, and I mean, there's something slightly jokey about it as well, something humorous about it. I mean, I think this I've been very serious and solemn about it, but this there is a certain whimsy to this. To this exaggeration. Again, I think that's where one can start to feel a relationship between the Vanbrugh's architecture and his drama.
Yes. On a different topic, maybe. Sorry.
That's okay.
Thank you very much for your talk, first.
Thank you.
Returning or trying to return to the possible problematical analogy between Vanbrugh's architecture and Vanbrugh's.
Was it you that talked about it?
Dramatic works.
Yeah,
yes.
Thought it might be fun.
And then gaping admirer of Vanbrugh's efforts still. I was particularly interested in your notion of the self-representational quality of Vanbrugh's architecture. And I wondered if you could agree if we tried to find it in his plays, thinking in particular of The Brother and Wife, which is, after all, which could be described as a comedy on marriage as comedy, or fiction on marriage as fiction.
Yes.
Do you see what I mean?
Yes, I do. Well, I went to see a Vanbrugh play for the first time, and I've tried reading them over the years, and I've always found them rather difficult to read, but I went to see one, and it was incredibly fresh and lively and funny, and I was struck at how exaggerated, caricatured the characters were, presumably for the reasons you've just been suggesting. And I think in both cases, it's a notion of decorum, really, that these are the appropriate ways of communicating certain kinds of character, certain stereotypes. So you make them, you scale them up, you make them grotesque. But to come back to your point, you used a phrase that it's a marriage about a... it's the self...
representation of...
Yeah, could you say that again? Well, it was the...
comedy on marriage. It's comedy, for example.
Yeah. I mean, I think in both cases, in order to do that, there has to be this sort of separate... There has to be this contrast between the appearance and the reality, as it were. Because if you can't prize them apart, you can't exaggerate, or the exaggeration would get lost, wouldn't it? Because you need to know what it is that's being exaggerated. And I think that's the point. Well, that's the only way I've managed to bring them together in a way that seems to me legitimate.
It's also a very interesting idea you introduced on the facade as commentary.
Yes.
The facade as commentary of a hidden or different reality.
Yes.
That could apply to the place as well, I think.
Yeah.
The facade, the social definition of the characters and a different reality behind the roles the characters play.
Yes, so again, it's that difference, isn't it? The knowledge of what they should be doing and being that you bring to watching them do these terrible things.
Beyond metaphors on the architecture of the play. After all, the buildings and the place come from the same mind.
Yes. Right? Yeah.
So there might be common denominators to the way he approached structure and construction, either of a plot or a building.
Yes. Yeah, I thought about that. I don't think it works formally in that way. I mean, in English, the word plot derives from diagrams, from drawings. So the notion of plotting a play actually comes from... In the period, the word is plat, often for a building, and a contract will refer to a plat. Plat, plot, they're all the same concept, but they're plotted, but I've not yet thought very systematically about whether there are more straightforward similarities. I don't think there are.
It's partly metaphorical.
Yeah. I think the fact that this house is doing two things, it's quite unusual for the front and the back of a house to be presented to the world as basically very different things, because it's illogical. If the facade is telling you something about the house, it should be saying the same thing on both sides, but it's like having, you know, two different faces. It's telling you that it's more than one thing, I think. And there's a letter which I didn't quote where... I think it's Hawksmoor this time, not Vanbrugh, and he writes to the Earl of Carlisle, and he's basically saying what we've achieved here is bigger and grander than anything Palladio's done, anything the French have done, anything anyone in Britain has done. And he says what you've created is a castle and a palace conjoined. And I think one could take that literally and see that this house is trying to do both those things. If I can just whiz back, shut your eyes if it makes you feel funny. If we look at this image here, and I've not said very much about this because the idea of strength is not so forcefully expressed here. I've talked a bit about the treatment of the bottom to suggest that it's got to be strong, but this is a very different feel, and exaggerated by this rather romanticising bride's head-like image, but the treatment of the low wings flanking the garden, I think, is inspired by a fashion about 1700 for low-story buildings that's ultimately inspired by the Trianon at Versailles. And there is a sense, I think, in which Castle Howard on this side is a kind of Trianon, a small garden palace, and the building, as you can see even from this image, addresses the garden. You can walk out from the garden hall, as it's called, and when you're walking down these sets of rooms, these apartments to left and right, the garden tells you where you are in the building. So there's a very close relationship. So I think in that sense there is something palatial and French, because, you know, France is, in terms of monarchy, is the great model for everybody. I mean, it's to France that these people are looking, and even the stoniness I've talked about. I don't think in French architecture it ever becomes quite so pictorial, but the celebration of the masonry nature of architecture is so fundamental to 17th century France in a way that it isn't really in Italy in ever quite the same way. France is what these people are dreaming. When they dream of buildings at night, it's French architecture, not Italian. I'm not just saying that because I'm here.
Bruce, and then Jeff.
I arrived a bit late, I'm afraid, so you might have mentioned this, but I was wondering who's in the niches. I'm wondering about
Well, I don't actually... This isn't a cop-out. I don't actually think they're anyone... They're brought. If we go, there's no consistent program in the iconography, and people have attempted to extract one. The accounts name mythological figures on the pediment on the garden front. I can't remember who they are, but they're broadly speaking suitable to the landscape and the garden. On the north side, they don't seem to be anything. They're just generic. There's an interesting thing where there are, a student pointed this out to me the other day when we were there, the figurative sculpture here, there are two here and two here, and they're male and male, female, female. There's some kind of gender stereotyping going on. But there is the only place where the non-architectural carving as such is has any eloquence is in the main frieze here, where the detailing is martial. But that's to do with the Doric order, I think. Because of Vitruvius, that the Doric is based on the proportions of the warrior, the male warrior. And that was standard practice. And François Monsard at Maison Lafitte, the Doric order there has exactly the same kinds of forms. But broadly speaking, that and the contrast between that and on the back where, well, I think on the back it's a whole series of dolphins, I think again it's less about what's being shown perhaps than the visual texturing effect on the garden front, the carved ornament enriches the facade. So it's less about what it is than what it does, if you see what I mean.
Jeff? Yes. Well, about the dome, you mentioned Palladio's Villa Rotunda, in which the small dome seems to integrate quite naturally into the building. But here, the dome here seems to surge
yes.
in the main part of the building. And how was it? Was it built afterwards? Because in the letter, Hawksmoor doesn't mention the dome.
He doesn't mention the dome because he's talking about the facades. But it's interesting. He doesn't talk about needing these forms to visually support the dome, as it were. It is there from the beginning, and I think it's part of this attempt at Castle Howard to create a building of extraordinary magnificence by pulling together a whole series of different architectural traditions. So there's the tradition of the English country house. If we look at the image on the right here, and when you first go to Castle Howard, you see a house, a big rectangular house, and then two wings coming out to either side. Now, I haven't discussed the fact that this house was completed later in the 18th century and the design was altered. I might have done, because the rejection of the design and the decision to build in a different style, I think, is part of the story I've been telling, that this growing revulsion at this kind of architecture. But the point I was going to go on to say is that if you take away the dome and you're down on the ground, what you see is in many respects what the grandest country houses in England of the late 17th century looked like. But you get more at Castle Howard. You get a dome, you get textured wall surfaces, which you don't ordinarily get in English country houses. You get them in, I mean, this level of surface enrichment is very French, but it's also typical of buildings such as this, which are royal projects. This is part of an abandoned royal palace. So there's clearly an attempt at Castle Howard to just make this building as grand as it possibly can be by throwing everything at it. And I think part of that is this idea of the great double-height salon that Vanbrugh, who was in France, I mean, he was in prison in the Bastille at Vincennes, but he would have, we know that he had some free time. The notion of the great vestibule as a domed space, I mean, I think that's a very French idea. I mean, it's normally combined with staircases, which it sort of is here. Another unusual, in an English context, but remarkable aspect of this building is the way the staircases, you can see the staircases are located beyond the main square of the hall, but they're opened up so you can walk up the stairs and look into the main space of the hall. That integration of dome and staircase is, I think, part of importing what's most swaggering and impressive about French architecture into this house. So, as I say, you throw everything at it. But the problem that it causes is that you're dropping a dome and the need to support the dome into what is otherwise a normal two-story English country house. So immediately you've lost, if you think of your house as like a cardboard box, you know, this size, and then you drop a dome in, you've lost all that space. And not only have you lost the space, but the structure is so complicated that you need additional spaces to support it. All of this is taken up by the dome and the need to support it. And all that's left on the front half of the house are these two really quite tiny apartments. And you've really only got three rooms. And I think that's one of the reasons why Castle Howard is so spread, because doing this means that where the functions that would normally be located in the main part of the house have to be pushed out. So that's a consequence of taking this French notion of the double height masonry dome space and dropping it into the grandest kind of English country house.
I've just thought about one last thing. Mm-hmm. You mentioned François Mansart, and one this dome is slightly reminiscent of the dome on the chapel of the Val de Grâce that was designed
yes.
by Mansart.
Yes. Yeah.
This coincidence.
But. Yes. Secular, the question of where there are secular domes is interesting as well.
Yes, thank you very much, Anthony, for this really stimulating talk. I've got so many questions, but I'm always returning to the Tudors for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering whether it would be pertinent to see this building as a sort of metaphoric representation of the Howard family itself, in a way.
Yes,
with
yes.
its enormous devouring ambition over generations and generations, never-ending ambition to push and thrust themselves ever upwards, but when doing so, actually perhaps throwing too much at it, as you just explained here in the building, and ending up with problems because of what was supposed to be serving the family ended up actually undermining its safety or its aggrandizement, whatever.
Yes.
And it's exactly the same with the building, it seems to me. It's very interesting. And Carlyle as well, the earldom of Carlyle, being stuck somehow between a rock and a hard place here, wanting to be looking towards England, but always looking, you know, checking its back because of Scotland and stuff. And I think the building seems to me to embody the what the family was trying to do and had been trying to do for generations.
Yes. Well, it's a building, as we've, for the reasons we've just been discussing, in architectural terms, it's a building of extraordinary ambition, and that ultimately, I suspect, is explained or initiated by exactly what you've just suggested. And more specifically, he's the Earl of Carlisle is a member of the Howard family, and the Howard family are the Dukes of Norfolk, which in the British peerage is the most ancient and therefore the most senior. But they were Roman Catholic. Post-Reformation, they were Roman Catholic, and hence the troubled history of the family in the 16th and later in the 17th centuries. So there's a sense here in which he wants to be part of the Howards, but is also trying to perhaps... I don't know. Well, no. I think it's about wanting to demonstrate that connection and
the uniqueness of the family as well.
Yes.
Nobody else has got this sort of architecture.
No.
In the same way as nobody else has the magnificence and the staying power of the Norfolks.
No.
Despite the odds.
That's right. And they did own this estate previously. but the Earl of Carlisle, before this house was built, was based up in the far northwest of England, near the border with Scotland, in Cumbria, and the decision was made to move here. And I've talked about this house as being a castle, and there's a sort of chivalric idea going, which we can begin to see in the building, and the decision to call it Castle Howard, which doesn't come until about 10 years into the building accounts when they start calling it Castle Howard. But meanwhile, out in the landscape, which I haven't talked about, this house has a remarkable extended landscape in which buildings are placed. And one of those buildings is another pyramid, not the pyramid we've just seen. And in that pyramid, which you can see from the garden, is a giant sculpture of the Earl of Carlisle's ancestor, who was a younger son of the Duke of Norfolk. So he's acknowledging that and the use of the pyramid and its associations with history in the landscape. Mm-hmm. So the idea of his aristocratic status and his connection to the Howards is there, is made explicit in the landscape. It's a monument that looks back. Meanwhile, there's a mausoleum, there's a famous mausoleum at Castle Howard, which is about the dynasty looking forward. So you've got this strong sense of the family's past, the family's future, and how the past and the future work together, because that's the nature of upper-class identity. You get your status because, you know, we talk about old families, but, you know, all of our families are as old as anybody else's families, but, you know, we know what we mean by an old family. It means that a family that's been at the centre of power for a long time. So you see all that at Castle Howard, and interestingly, you see it in the landscape. So again, it reminds us that equation between aristocratic, the roots of aristocratic status and the relationship to land ownership, which are so important. I mean, England never has its Versailles. It never has the forcing of the aristocracy to court. The country houses remain the principal power bases of these people. So the relationship between power and land and family history is all brought together in the wider landscape of Castle Howard in very extraordinary ways.
I was wondering as well, did they quarry their own stone?
Yes, the stone comes from the park, and you can still see various quarries. And if you look at a map, the Ordnance Survey map of this part of Yorkshire, you can see abandoned quarry all over the... So it does literally come... That's another element of these letters.
So magnificence, strength, durability coming from the actual land.
Absolutely, yep.
Thank you very much.
If I can just come back on that for a second... towards the end of your talk, I think, when you mentioned that strength and weight are difficult to know by sight alone, and you said that the viewer is nonetheless allowed to know solidity, and you really insisted upon that word, I think,
yes,
of knowing solidity. And talking about different modes of perception, for me, it was more a question of perceiving or experiencing solidity rather than knowing necessarily solidity.
Yes.
So I just wanted to know what was possibly the difference, and were they themselves aware of different modes of perception?
No, well, I mean, this is where I'm going with this project, trying to understand how the 17th century understood notions of architectural expression, really. And so people look at these buildings today and they talk about them as being expressive. And I want to understand, because I think they are expressive, but what I'm trying to do is to understand what's happening in these buildings, which I know is tricky because I'm suggesting that my experience is the same as their experience, but to a degree I think that is the case. But I'm trying to understand it within the framework of 17th century intellectual history.
And I suppose that was my second question about how you yourself as an art historian goes on about explaining that perception changes, and that even what we conceive as solidity might change. And, you know, to go back a little bit on what Natalie said at the beginning, said, well, you know, I actually think it's quite airy and soaring. Because, of course, I imagine when you work with the sort of history of reception of those buildings, you know, they have their own. But then, since then, obviously, you've got to work with layers and historical layers as well. And representations, illustrations, paintings, engravings, film sets, etc., etc., that we've seen. So I imagine the idea itself of solidity meant something quite different for the architects to what it means for us now. So how do you yourself work with those changing modes of perception?
Yes. Well, I don't really know yet. I'm about to sort of have a go. I mean, I don't have a clear sense of knowing and perception as being different things. That was perhaps not sufficiently precise use of language. I was going to say something else, sorry, and it's just vanished from my mind.
Because you just said that you think your experience might be in a way similar to
theirs. Oh yes, yeah. Well, what,
and that, that's what I was
the thought I had was that the experience, if I can use that word, that this architecture seems to the agency that these buildings seem to have seems to be consistent. But what seems to change, the historical change, is not that people stop feeling it, but they process it differently. So whereas in the early period it's deemed to be a good thing, so people do talk about it, you know, this is, you know, this magnificent strong house, people write approvingly, and then a generation later they're observing the same thing about it, but it's repulsing them. Do you see what I mean? So for me, I'm happy to accept there is a sort of almost trans-historical agency about this architecture, but it's the way that people process that shifts over time. Do you see what I mean? Rather than just saying, well, we see it differently, we come on. You know, I want to I want to give the building some kind of agency, you know, like these people. I believe in the real world and in these things.
We've got time, perhaps, for another couple of couple of questions. Perhaps just one last one, because just out of sheer ignorance, and I don't think you touched upon that in your talk, about the collaboration between the various architects. How does that work? How does it work?
Well, we don't really
know.
We don't really know, and people have written a lot about it. I've sort of avoided it because people write about
it
so much.
Okay.
I mean, I think it's partly a matter of class, in that Vanbrugh is a gentleman. He's a knight. He's a herald. He's a member of. He's closely associated with the court. He doesn't get paid for this in cash terms. He gets paid in terms of, you know, courtly culture, in that the Earl of Carlisle does him a favour. So you build me a house, and I'll make you a member of, I'll get you a position at court and everything that follows from that. Whereas Hawksmoor comes from a very different part of society, and it comes out of the office of Sir Christopher Wren. Hawksmoor can draw, which Vanbrugh can't. So there's an important social aspect to the relationship. But I think in real terms, and I spent a lot of time talking about how some of the outside of this building is highly decorated and some of it isn't. And I'm increasingly thinking that Vanbrugh, you know, went like this in the club and said, "There's your house." But the precise measured detailing is Hawksmoor. So I think the different zones of the building I've described, I now suspect, are also the different contributions.
Thank you. Anything else?
That's enough.
Otherwise, we can thank you once more.
Pleasure.
For
thank you.